Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State has denied a request from a prominent white nationalist to speak on campus. The University of Cincinnati has agreed to allow Richard Spencer to rent space for an event. Both institutions grappled with the same set of concerns, mostly public safety and financial related, after violent protests erupted on the campus of the University of Virginia in August. White nationalists had staged a torch-lit Unite the Right demonstration against plans to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee from public property. Here is sound from Unite the Right demonstrators and from the counter demonstrators.
We're honoring the founding fathers who were white. We're honoring all of the great white men who are being smeared and defamed and torn down.
These are familiar sounds of demonstrations and counter-demonstrations these days, but in this case, the events took a tragic turn when a white nationalist drove his car into a crowd of counter-demonstrators. He injured 20 people and killed one woman. We're talking about free speech on college campuses, what it means, and what it costs today. Joining us first is education reporter at Inside Higher Ed, Jeremy Bauer-Wolf. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote that likely these sorts of demonstrations and counter-demonstrations revolving largely around lightning rod speakers such as Richard Spencer are only going to become more common. What do we know? Has anyone analyzed the trajectory of these events in recent years and when they started and when they started to cost so much money?
Well, certainly, you know, the white nationalists themselves have said that their next target, and this has been going on since the election, was college campuses. You know, protests on college campuses, controversial speakers are obviously nothing new. But right after President Trump was elected, we saw Richard Spencer say, "My next stops are going to be these campuses. I'm trying to get under people's skin." And so far, we've seen him be, you know, experts have said that he's been relatively successful in certain cases. You know, students respond to his sort of rhetoric, especially liberal-leaning students that tend to comprise most college campuses. So again, we're going to continue to see this, and Richard Spencer has made very clear, especially since post-Charlottesville, that he's trying to increase his number of stops.
And when you say students respond, what you're talking about is the negative response.
Correct. Students, especially, again, liberal-leaning students who tend to comprise the populations of universities, are very vehement in their response. They read what Richard Spencer has said. You know, he's very public. He was a very big Trump supporter and emerged as a figure during the election. So I think that colleges and students on those campuses are expecting a response back to him.
Who else is out there besides Richard Spencer doing this?
Milo, for sure. Milo Yiannopoulos, the former Breitbart editor. To a lesser extent, I think some college presidents have said he's been a little bit more even-handed, has been Ben Shapiro, who's also an ex-Breitbart writer. Again, but we've also seen Ann Coulter. That was a very prominent example at the University of Berkeley. And she was very, very vocal about her appearance. Actually, she didn't actually appear there, but very, very vocal about her attempts to be at the University of Berkeley.
You said they're trying to get under the skin. It sounds more like this is an effort to, as you described, to get under the skins of this liberal, left-leaning student bodies versus attracting more right-leaning, sympathetic people.
Correct. So that's the way that most university presidents that we've talked to have characterized this, is that a lot of students, they urge students actually not to appear at these speeches because they say that's their intent. And again, these people, especially Richard Spencer, have made very public that they're trying to get under the skin of not only students, but the administrators there. They view the administrators as an academic establishment that is trying to promote only the left-leaning views on campus. So they're trying to break that narrative and shake up campus, so to speak. And again, certain conservative groups, especially students on certain conservative student groups on campus, have promoted these speakers. You know, mm-hmm. some universities have policies that state these speakers can't come to campuses unless there is a student group who backs them. So we have seen some examples of that as well.
Let's talk about what types of events these are. They are not necessarily invited by an organization from campus to appear, right? So they're targeting these public colleges and universities proactively. They're not being invited.
Correct. It can vary. You know, a lot of public universities have policies that allow speakers on campuses, any speakers on campuses. It is a free-for-all, so mm-hmm. to speak. So anybody from a Boy Scouts to Richard Spencer, if they put down enough money on a facility, can rent these spaces. Again, there are some universities, and Texas A&M is one of them, after Richard Spencer appeared there, is that a student group must back you to come. So, and that's legally allowed, experts say, because it's a content-neutral policy. But again, most universities, as you say, do have open a free-for-all, so to speak.
And they're not necessarily all like the Unite the Right rally at the University of Virginia. Lots of times they want to speak in a venue. They don't necessarily aren't always planning those kind of marches and stuff, right?
Right, right. So Milo, you know, I think was a very prominent example. He tried to make the university, the Berkeley Free Speech Week, into a very big event, right? Mm-hmm. 4 days of solid conservative speakers intended to provoke the campus. But some are a little bit more low-key. You know, there are some, you know, I think the University of Utah is a very good example, and I believe, I forget what speaker offhand, did appear there, and it was relatively uneventful. You know, some of these speakers, they come. Ben Shapiro was on Berkeley's campus semi-recently. He came, he spoke, a few people asked questions, and they left. So sometimes it is what we think of as the traditional speaker, where they come in, they just give their take, so to speak, and then they leave. So it's not necessarily the same visibility that we saw in Charlottesville, that we saw at Berkeley, that we saw at Middlebury, where Charles Murray was shouted down.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the student protests on college, or not the student protests, just question of free speech on college campuses, what it means, what it costs. My guest right now is Jeremy Bauer-Wolf. He's an education reporter at Inside Higher Ed. He's written about these recent white nationalist speakers on college campuses around the country. That seems to be the flavor this time around. If you have a question or comment, we want to hear from you after the break, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what happened last February at the University of California, Berkeley? They spent almost $1 million on security there, right?
So this is actually very recent. So we actually did see Milo Yiannopoulos, the former Breitbart editor, appear there in February. And he, I believe, if I remember correctly, it was, again, almost – I'm going to forget the figure offhand. I know very recently, however, for his Free Speech Week appearance, it was almost $1 million.
Oh, okay. That's what they were planning.
That's what they had planned on. So, again, and, you know, this – their estimate right now is $800,000. When I talked to a spokesman, the invoices were still coming in. So it's very possible that it could breach $1 million. Again, for this one appearance, one man, and again, by the university's account, he spoke for no more than 20 minutes. There were some very mild protests, and then he left. So it was, by their account, a very expensive visit for something relatively short.
Well, what are they spending all the money on? What are their metrics?
It's almost all manpower. You know, there are some cases where they're spending on actual physical barriers, you know, the water-filled barriers that can't be thrown or moved very easily. But in all cases, this is almost to bring in extra police presence for these speakers. And again, that's coming not only from their local, regional, but also state. And I believe they also relied on national forces in that case as well.
You interviewed Kevin Kruger of NASPA, Student Affairs Administrators in Higher Education. He said the penalty for underpreparing is significant. What did he mean by that?
So we saw that at the Charlottesville example, where the university president herself admitted that there were a number of deficiencies in their response. There was not enough police presence in that case, and they were heavily criticized for that. There was one policy that didn't allow an open flame on the university grounds that I believe just was relatively obscure, mm-hmm. And just wasn't enforced in that case. So there was a whole postmortem report detailing how they could have done better, and again, very heavily criticized for their response and their response leading up to it as well. The university president had made a number of statements, and she was publicly criticized for not naming the group as a white nationalist. So I think the University of Virginia is a pretty good example of what can happen when you underprepare.
How much do we understand that university officials are talking to each other about this issue? Is this something that's coming up at their meetings that they have over the summer and that kind of a thing?
Absolutely. You know, I think my editor, Scott Jaschik, just wrote about this recently. There was a number, I believe, upwards of 60 college university provosts, administrators, presidents who met recently to discuss this issue. And every time we have a college president come in here, we ask, what's your plan on this? And almost every, we always get the same answers that they have some sort of plan of action of this. You know, this is, again, as I wrote, this is not something that's going away. The white nationalists have said very publicly that they continue this tour. So the university presidents are developing responses, especially institutions like Berkeley, where it's the birth of the free speech movement. You know, this is being discussed very heavily.
The Ohio State University, in a letter to the lawyer, the Michigan lawyer representing the person seeking the venue for Richard Spencer, said that they're going to consider other alternatives for the request, to meet the request. Have other schools done that? I mean, can you give us a sense of the, kinds of responses? Is that pretty typical from universities like Ohio State that are trying to avoid it altogether, or what?
There's typically, I think we see two camps. There's either and I think we saw this more recently after Charlottesville, is where universities say, no, we're not going to accommodate you because of these safety concerns. And then again, you have the Ohio State University response saying, we're going to, no, but we're going to try to accommodate you. I couldn't tell you what an alternative is. Mm-hmm. However, there are a number of colleges that have made statements saying, you know, we're going to try to accommodate you in any way possible. Maybe it's not going to be on the date that you want. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not going to be on the venue that you book, but we're going to try to get you in there. And a lot of colleges have, presidents have said, you know, we do support this idea. We support the idea of free speech on campuses, but we might not be able to accommodate your exact request. So we've seen a number of institutions make changes in the time of day or the venue just because it's in part because of security concerns.
Has that satisfied the white nationalists who are seeking the venues? Has it spurred any? Now, there was a threat of a lawsuit. It's now on hold against Ohio State. We don't know what the deal is there, but has that satisfied it, those alternatives?
In many cases, no. You know, I think Ann Coulter is a very good example of this. When she was trying to speak at Berkeley, she was very vocal on Twitter saying that, you know, that the university was trying to stifle her because they had requested the date be postponed in some cases, or that the date was after or during the final exam week, rather. So she characterized this as, you know, the university is trying to make it not ideal for me to speak. You know, mm-hmm. they're trying to, you know, we're going to speak when students are in classes rather than maybe the ideal time when she wanted to. Mm-hmm. And again, that was a very clear example, and she was tweeting about that for days.
But she didn't sue.
She did not sue. However, and you know what? She didn't even actually show up in that.
Exactly,
case.
Right.
There were some protests. Actually, that was a very good example of very vocal protesters appearing on that campus, but she didn't actually show up there.
Jeremy Bauer-Wolf, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today very much.
Thank you so much for having me again.
You
appreciate
bet. It. It's Jeremy Bauer-Wolf, reporter for Inside Higher Ed. Coming up, we're going to turn to a couple of lawyers and representatives of organizations that have a stake in this issue. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about free speech on the campuses of public colleges and universities. Free speech, it turns out, is not free. It costs money to manage the demonstrations that surround this generation's lightning rod issues, not the least of which is right-wing nationalists such as Richard Spencer. He was at the heart of the August demonstration at the University of Virginia, in which a white nationalist rammed his car into a crowd protesting Spencer and his Unite the Right rally. 20 people were injured and one woman was killed in the attack. Now, Ohio State faces possible litigation after announcing this week that OSU would not provide a venue for Richard Spencer. The University of Cincinnati, on the other hand, decided that it would allow Spencer to speak on its campus. Joining us by phone is attorney and executive director of the First Amendment Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C., Latha Nutt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also by phone, attorney and vice president of policy research at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, a nonprofit civil rights watchdog group, Samantha Harris. Welcome, Samantha.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ohio State Senior Vice President and General Counsel Christopher Culley wrote on October 13th to Kyle Bristow. He's a lawyer representing the person who wanted to rent space for Richard Spencer to speak at OSU. The letter said that the university, quote, has determined that this request cannot be accommodated without substantial risk to public safety. He said it went on to say that, however, the university is currently considering other alternatives for that request and that it expects to be in touch by the end of next week, which is this week. Samantha Harris, does Ohio State get points for saying that it will talk about alternatives?
You know, I think that the issue is that schools, you know, when they cite this public safety rationale, they have to be very transparent about what the threat to safety is, because, you know, the risk obviously is that, you know, when a speaker is controversial or unpopular and a school is anticipating protests, they can cite that public safety rationale and then not have to give a reason for denying a venue to a speaker who really, you know, they disfavor on the basis of the content of the speech. But the reality is, obviously, we've seen the violence in Charlottesville. We know that there are some safety concerns. So, you know, what we've said on this issue is that schools really need, to the extent that there are genuine pressing safety concerns that make it difficult or impossible for a school to host a speaker, they need to be very clear about what those are and transparent so that it's not allowed to become a rationale for just denying a venue to an unpopular or controversial speaker.
So, Latha, is it matter if they say that they're considering other alternatives?
Well, I'd be curious to know what the other alternatives are, because either they are going to let Richard Spencer use their university, some space in the university as a forum, or they're not. So it really depends on what they come out with at the end of the week. But I do agree with Samantha that while safety can be a concern, they do have to be quite clear about what they are, what exactly the concern is. And of course, while a university can set reasonable rules and restrictions about campus speakers, the one thing they can't do is make those decisions based on what the speakers have to say. And while safety does seem like a viewpoint-neutral thing, if you take that to its logical conclusion, then no one with controversial or unpopular ideas would be able to speak somewhere if you were worried that they might provoke a hostile reaction.
We are talking about free speech on campus. My guests, Latha Nutt, she's executive director of the First Amendment Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C. Also with us, Samantha Harris. She's vice president of policy research at FIRE. That is a nonprofit civil rights watchdog group. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm going to turn right now to Robert in Cincinnati. You're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Ann. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Oh, so I've got a statement and a comment that I'd like to make. First thing I'd like to say is free speech. If you honestly believe in it, it doesn't matter how hateful, how disgusting, whether it's pro-racist, whatever, you would be in support of it. I'm a Navy veteran, and I'm even all for Colin Kaepernick's bending the knee. I think he has the right, and I served and protected this country for that. My question is why, for controversial things like that, speakers, why Ohio State and other universities don't require speaker to pay 85 to 95% of the security, the cost of the security.
Samantha Harris, what do you think?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court has held that speech can't be financially burdened any more than it can be banned because of its content. So what the actual quote was something like, you know, speech can't be financially burdened because it's unpopular with bottle throwers. So while, for example, schools can have content-neutral rules that require student groups or speakers to pay security, but what they can't do is say, well, because you're controversial, you are going to require more security because people are going to protest you, so therefore we're going to attach an extra cost to your speech. They can't financially burden that speech because of its content. So that is why you can't require a speaker to pay varying fees for security based on the controversial or non-controversial nature of their speech.
Robert, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. Lutha, demonstrations and counter demonstrations on campus are not new. What does history tell us about previous efforts to muzzle one or the other?
Well, that again, I believe Jeremy was saying earlier that Berkeley is the place where the free speech movement was born. They're
right.
Used to having a lot of demonstrations and counter demonstrations. And the interesting thing is that if you try to muzzle one group's right to speak, then that basically gives the university the power to decide who can speak and who can't speak. And so free speech rights are indivisible. If you deny one group that right, eventually the right will be denied to any group that's unpopular with a current university administration.
Al in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Al.
Hi. My question is, wouldn't it be possible to have Mr. Spencer spend an hour on WOSU? You wouldn't have a crowd.
Yeah. What about the venue? I mean, could when Samantha Harris, when the university's considering alternatives, of course, they don't run OSU. I mean, you know, we're independent. They couldn't force us to do it. But what about that?
Well, I think what people would be looking at in terms of, whether proposing an alternative venue was in some way limiting a speaker's right to free speech is if somebody wanted to speak at a central location on campus and the university said, well, we can't do that, but there's this warehouse, 3 miles down the road off campus that's agreed to rent you the space, that would be burdening the speech. So I think, again, it's really going back to the issue of transparency. I mean, if the university has legitimate reason to believe that there is going to be, violence that will overwhelm the capacity of their police department to manage the situation, then they need to be upfront about that. They need to disclose the kinds of threats they were received. They need to, talk about consultations they've had with law enforcement. They can't just say, well, we can't accommodate it, so we need to push it somewhere else. I think it's less an issue of what they ultimately decide than how clear they are about what's going on so that people can see whether or not the decision was made legitimately on the basis of content-neutral security issues or on the basis of, the speaker's opinion.
Hmm. Letha, not, I mean, the suggestion that, they get an hour on the radio station or something like that. There's another issue there involved controlling the press too, right?
Oh, if the university were to say that WOSU has to host this. Yeah, absolutely. That would be, I don't think that you can demand that a press outlet or a news media outlet give someone coverage. I think that there'd be a possibility if maybe there was a university radio station for having him present there. But again, they'd have to be very transparent about exactly what the safety risks are to prove that that's the only way that he can communicate with the students of Ohio State.
Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
First, let me say, as an alumnus of the University of Cincinnati, I'm ashamed that they've granted this Richard Spencer access to their campus.
Why?
And secondly, his hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but that is it. The man is his ideology is contrary to everything this nation was founded upon. And he's using the concept that he's not directing or inciting or producing imminent lawless action or inciting such action imminently, that's to get around the concept of hate speech as being protected speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's you see it in Brandenburg versus Ohio in 1969.
Okay, so he's not inciting violence. You just disagree with the content of his speech.
He's not inciting imminent lawless action or likely to incite or produce such action.
So he should be able to speak.
The concept of imminence.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Imminence is a rationale to get around the concept of hate speech not being protected speech.
Okay.
I'll listen off air.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Samantha Harris, FIRE released results of a new survey on student free speech last week, and it was a report. An insider inside higher ed said that some of the answers appeared contradictory, sort of like that last caller. I mean, he's ashamed of the University of Cincinnati for having Richard Spencer speak on campus, but he kind of, you know, defends to the death his right to say it, right?
Right. Hate speech, a lot of European countries have hate speech laws where, you know, the kinds of expression that Richard Spencer engages in would not be allowed, would not be protected. We don't have that in this country. For better or for worse, I would argue for better. Someone like the caller would argue for worse. The First Amendment protects most speech that people would consider deeply hateful. The argument for that is there are many aspects to it, but one of them is that, you know, you need to let good ideas and bad ideas duel it out in the marketplace of ideas, and that's where real change happens, that by driving, ideas like Richard Spencer's underground, you sort of only give them more mystique and more credence, whereas, you know, when he's allowed to get up and air his views alongside other people, ultimately those bad ideas will be marginalized, if not altogether driven out of the marketplace of ideas. I mean, you know, we see it happening. The more that these people's speeches get canceled, they're taking up the banner of free speech martyrs. And it seems to be, you know, at least in certain circles, giving their cause a lot more credibility. Whereas if people were just tuning them out, they wouldn't have that. They wouldn't get to take up that banner of, you know, marching under the cause of free speech. Yes, there is that contradiction in that a lot of people, I mean, first of all, many people, you know, the caller seemed pretty well informed. A lot of people don't understand that hate speech is generally constitutionally protected. You know, hate speech is not free speech, is something we very commonly hear said. There's obviously a debate to be had about, you know, theoretically whether hate speech should or should not be protected. Again, I would argue it should be, but, our legal system does protect it, and the University of Cincinnati is a public university. So, at the moment, their hands are tied as far as banning hate speech goes, whatever they think about it.
Lafanat, what about media coverage of these issues? What is your sense about how well the media covers First Amendment issues when it comes to this kind of hate speech?
Well, I think that, as Samantha said, a lot of times it's a lot of people don't really understand that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment, and that, you know, we can talk about whether it's good or bad, but it is legal. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think the media coverage doesn't quite address that. Generally, I think the coverage of events like this, the media's been doing a pretty good job, like capturing, well, what's been going on and what the reactions are from students. So I don't think that's necessarily a problem, but I do think that people should be better informed about what their First Amendment rights are and how they work, that you can hate Richard Spencer and everything that he has to say, but understand that it is legal for him to say these things.
You know, just as I was for lack of a better word, trolling for sound for the show, my sense was that the media doesn't really cover what they're saying. They cover the reaction to what they're saying. And that kind of, you know, I led with what the white nationalists were saying in the University of Virginia, because I thought it's important to hear what they're saying.
I think that's a very good point because, you know, we like to say that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. And as Samantha was saying, like, letting these hateful ideas be taboo and forbidden does give them a certain mystique. I think if you actually hear some of the things they're saying, it's like, aside from being hateful, they sound ridiculous. And I think that's a good thing to get out there, to engage with that speech. And I always think that, you know, when student groups try to shut down an event, basically using the heckler's veto by drowning them out, you know, I think the better thing to do is be prepared to engage with these people and argue against them and pose pointed questions. And basically, you know, that I think that drowning them out doesn't really accomplish this as much as actually, like, exposing their ideas. If you think their ideas are ridiculous and a fallacy, then you should expose them as such, not tell them that they cannot speak.
We are talking about free speech on college campuses. Free speech isn't free. It costs a lot of money these days to manage demonstrations and counter demonstrations and that sort of thing. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. Should Richard Spencer be permitted to speak on the Ohio State University campus? At this point, OSU has said that he will not. They're looking at alternative venues. We're not sure what they mean by that. They said that they'll let the world know by the end of the week. If you have a question or comment, my guests are Latha Knott. She is Executive Director of the First Amendment Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C. Also with us, Samantha Harris. She's Vice President of Policy Research at FIRE, that stands for Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's a nonprofit civil rights watchdog group. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about free speech on the campuses of public colleges and universities. Still with us by phone is attorney and executive director of the First Amendment Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C., Latha Knott. Also by phone, attorney and vice president of policy research at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, a nonprofit civil rights watchdog group, Samantha Harris. If you have a question or comment, want to weigh in on this issue of whether white nationalists such as Richard Spencer should be able to speak on the Ohio State University campus, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ohio State, for the time being, has turned down a request by Spencer's group to have him speak here. The university said that it would notify the world by the end of this week about potential alternatives to that. Once again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Latha Knott, about 300 colleges and universities adopted hate speech codes in the early 1990s. Do you know what the trigger for that was at the time? Because it seemed like a relatively peaceful time to me.
You know, in the 1990s, there did arise a lot of, and this is a good thing, this awareness that, you know, campuses were becoming more diverse and that, you need to respect people's diversity. And also, I mean, I think generally colleges were like, well, with a more diverse population, we want to put codes in place to make sure that people aren't offending other students. Of course, the problem with that, I think, is that these codes are invariably too broad, meaning that, like, they cover not just speech that's, you know, like threatening speech, but also speech that would be constitutionally protected. For example, I think the University of Michigan, they had a hate speech code that was challenged in court and declared unconstitutional, and it basically prohibited speech that would offend another student. And that's extremely broad. It's also very vague because you would not know in advance what would offend another student. Mm-hmm. But I think these codes, I think they come from a good place, an idea that we want to make sure that everybody on campus gets along. But that in itself sort of stifles open political speech.
Yeah, exactly. Samantha Harris, offense, is there anywhere in law that defines what offends somebody?
No, and
no.
Oh, sorry, that question wasn't for me. I apologize.
That's okay.
Sorry, no. So, no, there's not. And in fact, you know, harassment, the Supreme Court has required that when we're talking about harassment in the educational setting, that in addition to having to be severe and pervasive to the point where it, you know, actually materially interferes with someone's ability to get their education, it has to be, quote, objectively offensive. That is, it has to be offensive not just to the victim, but to a reasonable person in the victim's position. Because otherwise, you know, everyone's free speech rights would just exist at the mercy of the most sensitive members of the community. So, you know, they have this reasonable person standard in the law, and courts have held again and again that subjective listener reaction is not a legitimate basis to regulate speech. But we do still see a lot of schools maintaining speech codes that, you know, define the permissibility of speech with regard to the reaction of the listener. Now, that said, written speech codes of the kind that we're talking about here have actually been on the decline, and that's a very good thing.
Hmm.
You know, the percentage of schools, we survey every year about 450 schools, and we look at, you know, what written policies they have restricting student and faculty speech. The percentage of schools maintaining those kinds of policies has gone down over the years, particularly at public universities that have these First Amendment obligations. Now, of course, that's separate from how schools actually handle free speech controversies in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And as we see, there are still a lot of issues there. But hate speech codes are on the decline, and that's something that we hope will continue. And we'd like to, you know, obviously compliment with helping schools handle these things better in practice.
Why do you think they're on the decline? Is it because they're litigation magnets or what?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few reasons. You know, in, I believe it was 2015, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte,
mm-hmm.
sent a letter to all of the he used FIRE's actually annual report on speech codes, and he wrote a letter to all of the public universities that had what we deem define as the most restrictive speech codes, saying, you know, it's come to my attention that you have policies that violate the First Amendment. And obviously, as public institutions, you're obligated to uphold that. So can you explain to me, you know, why you have these policies? And we saw a tremendous number of schools change their policies in response. So, you know, his letter, just publicity and attention drawn to these policies, lawsuits, those things have all played a role.
Dale in Mount Sterling, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi, Ann.
Go ahead.
I just have a short comment here. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people are saying we shouldn't allow hate speech on campus. I heard a quote, and I can't remember who it was from, a significant number of years ago, that says, the way to defeat hate speech is with more speech. So what we really need to do is speak out using the good arguments, logical arguments, instead of emotional ones, to counteract everything that's said.
Dale, thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye. Lise in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Lise.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to offer up the comment that, you know, we're talking a lot about the First Amendment and free speech
mm-hmm.
in regards to these white nationalists wanting to speak on campus, in particular Richard Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the United States, we have gotten a little too flexible about what is regarded as free speech. There really needs to be a line drawn somewhere, and I think that line should be that line should happen somewhere before you start to advocate ethnic cleansing. When a person's philosophy actively advocates ethnic cleansing or any system that establishes certain groups of people as arbitrarily inferior to others, then you've reached a point where you're actually doing more harm by offering up these ideas.
How are they doing? Well, Lise, how are they doing more harm? Tell me that.
So it undermines the fabric of liberal democracy, liberal democracy being a democracy that protects the interests of minorities. When these ideas are given legitimacy, when they're offered up in a forum such as, say, a public university,
mm-hmm.
then we are automatically acting under the assumption that these ideas deserve the same legitimacy as, well, things that aren't ethnic cleansing.
You know, Samantha Harris and Lise, thank you so much. Samantha Harris, in a country that has, you know, kind of... you know, sort of underscoring everything in this country is the notion that all men are created equal, women too. And what about what Lisa's saying? I mean, doesn't this just fly in the face of just the basic fundamental perspective we have on humankind here?
Well, I mean, his views certainly do. But whether we should suppress his views or allow them to be aired is a very different question. And if I may, I would love to share, because whenever this question comes up, you know, one of the most powerful counterarguments to what Lisa's saying is by an author named Jonathan Rauch. He wrote a book called Kindly Inquisitors. He's someone who – he's gay, and he grew up in the 1960s at a time of great discrimination and hatred. And yet he believes very strongly that we should not – suppress hate speech. And if I may, I'd love to share a quote from an article he wrote on the 20th anniversary of his book that I think best lays out that counterargument. May I do that?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay. So he wrote, "You cannot be gay in America today and doubt that moral learning is real and that the open society fosters it. And so 20 years on, I feel more confident than ever that the answer to bias and prejudice is pluralism, not purism. The answer, that is not to try to legislate bias and prejudice out of existence or to drive them underground, but to pit biases and prejudices against each other and make them fight in the open. That is how, in the crucible of rational criticism, superstition and moral error are burned away." So I think that is, to me, the strongest formulation of the argument for why, even in a society that, as the caller says, and I think as we would all agree, should be fostering tolerance and openness and you know, a society in which Richard Spencer's, you know, views should be anathema, why we should still allow them to be aired.
Lathanat, do you chime in or?
Oh, yeah. I think that that's a wonderful quote. And I think that it's true that you want these discussions out in the open. I don't think that necessarily banning someone from talking about something means that the ideas disappear. I mean, if you look at before the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany, the Weimar Republic had hate speech laws. It had laws against saying hateful things on the basis of ethnicity and religion. And these laws were enforced. That didn't necessarily – I mean, that certainly did not make the ideas underpinning Nazism go away. It just made them fester underground.
Josette in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Josette.
Hi. I just believe that we should have free speech for everyone, that we can't start picking and choosing what we're going to allow for this person or that person without eventually taking it away from everybody. And I think that it's an easy a slippery ride when we start saying that, you know, what you say is okay, and then what 20 people decide I say is not, you know, and then the next 20 people decide what you say is not. I think it's just a really dangerous place to play with our freedoms. And once we start squishing freedoms for anybody, eventually it's going to come to us, because that is the nature of what happens.
Thanks for your call, Josette. You know, it was brought up earlier that in Western Europe, they ban hate speech, Germany in particular. But correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't squelch hate thoughts. It doesn't squelch racist or national, you know, white nationalist movements. Does it, Samantha?
It certainly doesn't seem to. I mean, we have been witnessing, you know, the rise of the alt-right in Europe just the way we've been seeing it here in the United States. And I think, you know, it's something that both Lata and I have said today, is that you don't, you know, by telling people you can't say that, you don't change the way they think. If anything, their views become more firmly entrenched. I mean, when was the last time somebody's mind was changed by being told, no, you can't air your views? Right. I mean, that just puts people on the defensive and automatically shuts their mind down to opposing points of view. You know, it's really engaging with people with opposing views. We have an episode of our podcast, Fire is a podcast called So to Speak, where we interviewed someone named Daryl Davis, who's a black musician who actually went out over the years and engaged with and spoke to members of the Klan and challenged their views. And he got a number of people to leave the Klan, not by telling them that they couldn't say what they wanted to say, but by actually talking to them, hearing what they had to say, talking to them about what he believed. So that's how you're going to change minds. And certainly there are some people whose minds are never going to be changed, But again, do we want to give those people the opportunity to see themselves as martyrs, or do we want to have them have to, you know, fight their ideas out in, you know, an open and tolerant society like ours?
Let's see. Ken in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Ann. So a couple things. First off, I'm an ancient historian, so I tend to look at things through the eyes of the past, particularly the way things worked in Athens and an actual democracy, actual true democracy as opposed to a republic. But one of the things that they focused on was this idea of parrhesia, the close approximation of the idea of free speech. So anybody could stand up in the ecclesia, the assembly, and be able to make their voice, their opinion heard, regardless of how stupid or unpopular or amazing it very well may have been. And it's kind of like on the Gong Show. You have somebody stand up and they sing their song, and after two sour notes, they get gonged off the stage unless they sound pretty good. And so the best way to take care of these people is to let them speech, to discredit themselves, because they'll open up their mouths and sound like morons that they are.
But what about people who, like, bring whistles to events like that and whistle them down and drown them out? You're saying that's okay?
No, I'm saying shouting them down, as far as acting like a heckler at a comedy club,
yeah,
isn't necessarily the right answer. So once you have somebody that's up there and they're speaking and they sound dumb, they'll eventually lose the crowd and they'll lose the audience. So it's easy to make those rational arguments against them. Say, man, you know, again, this guy's clearly talking about genocide. That is that is not cool.
Okay.
So,
All right.
by burying them, they're just going to become more powerful.
Ken, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
We got time for one more. Richard in Columbus, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Ann.
And Richard, we're running out of time, so I want to get you in.
Okay. I've got this all figured out for OSU.
Okay.
They can put Richard Spencer, you know, all the agriculture land up by Don Scott off the sawmill on Hard Road?
Yeah.
A sheep barn. You know, it's all fenced. And,
okay.
You know, lovely country, lovely atmosphere.
Can be.
Or OSU Hospitals East. They've got a big parking lot.
Okay.
And it's surrounded by inner city, and it's just the people who would like to hear Richard Spencer talk.
Richard, you're hysterical. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
That is all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Samantha Harris, Vice President of Policy Research at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, a nonprofit civil rights watchdog group. Samantha, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Lata Knott, she is an attorney and executive director of the First Amendment Center at the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.